This show is brought to you by Safety FM.
Did you say on all of your kids you never used the stair gate?
Yeah, that's a good story. Me and my wife have had this rational discussion, like you do, because you think you're going to be in control of everything when you have kids. Little do you know, when they get to be adults and they go out into the world, we want them to understand risk and how to manage it, and we want them to understand responsibility. Then we had our second child, and I'm not going to make judgment, but this was a male child. Maybe a little bit different. And we went through the same procedure, and he fell down the stairs, and he fell down the stairs, and he fell down the stairs, and I turned to my wife and said, I'm going to go out and buy a stair gate. I think there's a lot of lessons of life. You can learn from the adult experience how to parent, and I think you can learn from the parenting experience things about leadership.
The words you're saying I love, but I'm telling you now, I feel uncomfortable with my daughter just walking to school on her own. It makes me feel terribly uncomfortable. It's not just about the kids feeling comfortable with risk, it's about the parents. It's probably more about the parents feeling comfortable with risk, right?
I actually felt quite angry because I thought somehow the world had decided that how women are is okay and how men are is not okay.
It's not okay. Yeah, totally agree.
You could say about a woman, oh, there's something hormonal or menopause is an issue and it affects you. And then you've got a teenage boy who's full of testosterone and he's just a thug.
Even more so, having a girl, as much as I don't want to force my daughter to do anything, I really want to heavily encourage her to get into martial arts, knowing that she can look after herself. Yeah. I think that's massively underrated as well.
When I worked in production, one of the stories I had was a guy who just came up and was shouting in my face. If someone shouts at you, you want to shout back. If someone hits you, you want to hit back. And there's kind of this natural reaction. Someone said to me, responsibility means having the ability to respond. You're in charge. You're the manager. Your responsibility is not to just react to this guy shouting at you, is to listen. And it turned out it was a safety issue. He had this issue that no one had dealt with, and he was angry. It's fear. Anger comes from fear. And in terms of creating a good culture or a step in the right direction, that whole incident taught people that I was prepared to listen.
Do you know what? I pondered this a lot since we found out it was a boy, and I am curious to see if I am different. And kind of like, well, I might have to be. One's a boy and one's a girl. One's Maggie and one's name pending. Yeah. They are different people. So the answer should probably quite confidently be, yes, I will be different. But that feels wrong. I want to say no, I'll treat them all the same.
Again, relating it to the workplace, we talk about equality and we say that everybody should get the same. No, everybody should get what they need.
I apply a lot of my work to raising my children, but I probably do take a lot of raising my children into work, if I'm honest, and the two are interchangeable. Yeah. If we think about what we're trying to achieve, it's like safer, healthier workplaces, right? For me, that starts with raising children that can have adult-to-adult conversations, that can assess risk themselves, that can have a good understanding of risk.
Your style is critical parent. The reason I know that is because I'm reacting as rebellious child, because that's how I react as a critical parent.
John, welcome to the podcast, mate.
Hi, James. Good to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
No problem, mate. I'm actually quite surprised that you hadn't been on before, actually. But I thought you had, but I don't think you have you, if I remember rightly?
No. This is the first one. Yeah.
Oh, cool. Have you done other podcasts before?
I have, yeah. I've done a couple in this format, so as a guest on on someone else's podcast. But yeah, I've done a couple. It's quite a nice experience.
All the rage now, mate. Back in the day when I started, there was barely any of us.
And you realise how things have changed, because I do a lot of work with IIRSM. I'm chair of the European branch. Now, we used to have face-to-face meetings. We had a Swiss network before we became the European branch, and they were great. And we had occasional webinars. And then during the pandemic, we started off with webinars that were, huge attendance, or big attendance at least. And now it's kind of struggling what to do, because nobody wants to go and join a webinar live. They might watch the recording later, but they're 10 a penny. There's so many of them around, and trying to find some sort of, to use a phrase, a unique selling point that gets people interested is really difficult. So we're trying to get back to more face-to-face stuff. But yeah, there is so much material online now, and you can't watch it all, you can't listen to it all.
I do find as well, John, like, and we'll come on to our topic because we've created a new topic out of just this little intro, but I find a lot of it just exhausting. Like no matter what platform you turn on, TikTok, YouTube, Instagram, it's just everyone, I feel like I'm being coached everywhere. Like I feel like I can't, and maybe that's just my cookies, but like everything I turn on and it's just like someone saying, don't eat this because it'll kill you. And then the next one is like, don't eat that because that'll kill you. And it's like, well, the last guy just said you could eat. And then there'll be a safety person or a business consultant or whatever it is. I just feel like I'm being coached every 5 minutes. The content is just a bit overwhelming, I find, a lot of the time. I just sometimes want to finish my work day and watch some stupid shit. Like, you know, like You've Been Framed. That's all I want to watch on TikTok. Yeah.
And I think it's there's a lot of stuff, you know, things you need to know, things you should do. Yeah, and I don't want to be told that. I can decide what I should do and what I need. So I don't know if that's the same thing as the coaching, but yeah, it's kind of been pushed on you. And I'm the format I like, well, maybe it's more like this, where there's just a kind of discussion and you can take away what you want.
Just it's, a pondering of thoughts,
Yeah.
Which, talking of telling things what to do, our topic of today is I suppose raising a household or running a household, but how we utilize what we've learned in safety, risk management, human performance, and so on and so on, and how we use those in our families and our household. Now we kind of came up with, well, we started having this conversation, John, probably on like beer 3 or beer 4, I think it was, in Berlin, which I thoroughly enjoyed that conversation, and the chance to continue that or kind of rehash it, I think is really cool. But I'm trying to think of a place for us to start this conversation, but there is one thing that you said that if you're comfortable with starting with, I'd like to start with the fact that you, I think, did you say on all of your kids you never used the stair gate?
No, that was that's a good story. I'll tell the story. Because in Berlin, as you say, we may have had one or two beers and we're up that tower in Berlin and we're having this conversation. We must have, talked about safety for 20 seconds before moving on to something else. And we started talking about our own childhoods we're at a different stage. So you were talking about your daughter and I talk about my kids and grandchildren now.
Yes.
So, but the stairgate story was, me and my wife had this rational discussion, like you do, because you think you're going to be in control of everything when you have kids. Little do you know before they arrive. But we said we're going to, the conversation was along the lines of, when they get to be adults and they go out into the world, we want them to know two things. We want them to understand risk and how to manage it. And we want them to understand responsibility. And we felt if we've done that when they're 18 and they disappear or whenever they leave, then we've done a good job. So
nice.
And the idea was you start with a little bit at a time. And then by the time they're 18, they got the full picture. So we started when our first child started moving around and discovered the stairs. And we said, right, no stair gate. Because she needs to learn that the stairs are dangerous and she will learn. And sure enough, she climbed up the stairs and was so proud of herself by about step 3 that she sat back with a big smile on her face and promptly fell down the stairs. And I said to my wife, that's it, great. Now she's going to learn. And she did. That was the last time she fell down the stairs. So we didn't buy a stair gate. Then we had our second child, and I'm not going to make judgment, but this was a male child. Maybe a little bit different. and we went through the same procedure, and he fell down the stairs and he fell down the stairs and he fell down the stairs. And I turned to my wife and said, I'm going to go out and buy a Stairgate. Because he just wasn't learning. So it's also, we felt fully justified after the first one. And the second one, you're, yeah, these kids, they're all different and they behave in different ways and do different things. And you've got to have the awareness of how they're going to react. So we had to take some different approaches with him. And he was the, like all middle children, I think, was the one who was always the one who learned things a bit differently from the other two and did things a bit differently.
What happens if you only have two? So we've got Maggie and then we've got our second on the way. We're not going to have a third. We've agreed that we're not going to have a third. What happens if you only have two? Is no middle child.
There is no middle child. I'm worried now. Maybe just avoid all of that difficulty. Yeah.
Just both and are going to be a pain in the ass.
And I think it's a sensible decision. The other thing I really remember, one of those, you remember that sitcom Outnumbered? And I remember the point when we were outnumbered.
Okay.
So two adults, three kids. And yeah. We went to Tintagel Castle in Cornwall. And it's not a castle as you think of it. It's like a bit of rock off the coast with sheer cliffs into the sea. So they didn't need to build walls. And we crossed this little bridge and the three kids ran off in different directions. And at this point, me and my wife looked at each other and thought, shit, there's three of them and we have to pick two that we're going to go after.
Going to at least lose one.
And we decided in the end, again, you know, maybe it's the wrong judgment, but we decided our daughter was the most sensible. And we went after the two boys. Nobody fell off. But at this point when we realised that this is out of control, and we'd always had the idea we'd have four kids, and that was the point at which we really finally decided three is definitely enough.
Maybe
too many.
I love it. I like what you were you're talking about like you've just set yourselves kind of two clear things that you wanted to achieve. Yeah. Like these are our kind of non-negotiables or our aim or whatever. Well, you've kind of done something similar with Maggie and what we'd like to do with the second as well, which I'm not saying is easy. So ours was and Maggie's kind of picking up on it. So we've simplified it. What our aim was that she'll always feel comfortable to come and tell us anything. So that was always our aim. So no matter what it was, she is comfortable to tell us. So really the kind of rule is nothing's taboo to talk about in this house. And she's three at the moment. So we've had to like really simplify that. And what we're trying to simplify it to at the moment is we don't tell lies in this house. So we just tell the truth. And she's picking that up. Like I'll say to her, like, if, I don't know, get her like some sweets or something. And I'm like, oh, don't tell mummy. Don't tell mummy. And she turns around to me now and says, like, no, we don't tell lies in this house, daddy. And I'm like, shit, this is backfiring on me already. But that was like the one thing we wanted to achieve was that they always come to us with anything. But what's really interesting, literally this morning this happened, where Maggie had done something a little bit naughty. And you know what it's like when they're three, they're desperate to tell you, but they don't want to tell you because they're worried about the consequences. She comes in with a smile on her face, like we know she's done something naughty. And she's got the thing that she's done. So we know what she's done. And we're like, at first, both me and Sherry, my wife, were like, basically what she does is she likes mixing things. So she'll get like washing up liquid, vinegar, she gets everything, salt, olive oil, and she just mixes it. But she'll hopefully. She puts it, goes to put it in her mouth, and this is where I think she won't be a chemist, right? Because she goes to eat it. And I'm like, Maggie, no, don't eat it. It'll make you very poorly. And Sherry tells her a lot, and I tell her a lot. And she'd come in with this spoon, and she was had a massive smile on her face, just as she had come inside to talk to me. And and she was like, Sherry was like, have you ate some of it? She was like, no. And we knew she had. And we were going, and I could tell that we were getting to this point where, like, we were going to tell her off. But then I realised she's not, or I or we realise she's not telling us because she knows she's going to get told off. So we're like, you won't get told off, but I want you to tell us what you've done. And that's really hard because you're like, she's broken a rule, but then she's not going to get punished for the rule. And that's how we're kind of trained, isn't it? Like you break a rule, you get punished. You break a rule, you get punished. But actually we were kind of like trying to explore the idea of like, we'd rather know when you broke the rule instead of punish you for breaking the rule, then we can have a conversation. In which that's exactly what happened. She said, yes, I put one spoon in my mouth. So now we know she hasn't drank the whole bloody bowl of washing up liquid or whatever it was. So we were like, okay, cool. It's not an A&E trip, which is the first box ticked. The second point was like, we can have a conversation with her. So we can say like, look, made it very poorly, baby. You don't want to do that. And she's like, yeah, I know, I'm sorry. And it felt, I mean, I don't want to sound like I'm preaching, like I'm definitely not, you know, like a all hail dad, you know, you should follow my rules. That's not what I'm saying. It was just this experience that we've recently had of trying to stick to our own non-negotiables. Like it's harder than what a lot of stuff out there kind of preach about, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's really hard. And I think that there's a risk in this conversation, because if we're relating it to what we do as our work with health and safety in the adult world, we don't want to give the sense that you treat employees like children. That's not the point. But there's a lot of lessons of life you can learn from the adult experience, how to parent, and I think you can learn from the parenting experience, you know, things about leadership. And I think what you highlight is that sometimes the unintended consequences of you do the right thing, but you haven't thought through all of the possible outcomes. And your daughter at 4 years old is in a very different position from you, and she's going to think about things differently. And then how do you deal with that? And it does relate to the workplace bit, where you want one of the big words at the moment is psychological safety, and you want that environment. You want an environment where people speak up, and you know it's the statement that you can learn or you can blame. You can't do both. Mm-hmm. And what you want in that situation is you want your daughter to learn, and so that in the future, when there's a learning opportunity, she doesn't clam up and hide it and pretend nothing happened, but she talks to you, and that prevents worse happening. And that's related to that whole thing about risk management. Do a little bit of risk, and then a bit more, and a bit more, and a bit more, so they understand how to manage it. So I think it's a great example that you also then learn as a parent, and in the workplace you learn as a leader, because you don't know everything when you start, and you as you go through this process you learn a lot.
It is definitely not like easy though, is it? Because you know what you were saying earlier about when you were telling the Stairgate story, which I absolutely love. You said something where you're like, you obviously don't want to see your kids get hurt, but at the same time, we want to expose them to some aspect of risk. Like part of life is exploring risk, right? Taking risk, doing stuff, climbing trees, the risk of falling out of the tree, and so on and so on. And I find it really interesting, actually, because Maggie's fourth birthday is at the end of this month, and she loves two things. She loves climbing stuff, like climbing frames and stuff like that. And she loves trampolines. The trampoline is probably the thing that she enjoys the most. She loves going on a trampoline. Cousins have got a trampoline. Her friends have got a trampoline. But me and Shez have seen some pretty nasty injuries on a trampoline. And recently have one of our friends' daughters have really smacked their face on the trampoline. And Sherry was like, I'm not sure I want to get her one now. And it's like, well, that risk was kind of there before. It just wasn't so visibly, like, we didn't have that recency bias. Like, we've got a recency bias now because we know someone's had it really recently. But like 2 years down the line, if nothing's happened, that recency bias disappears. And now all of a sudden we're like, oh, trampolines are safe. No, they're no more dangerous or safer. Yeah. They're just, we've just not had any incidents. But ultimately, there's a risk in everything that we do, right? Like if we look at some of the, some of the most successful sports in the world, all have an aspect of risk, and some of them really serious risk. Yet we kind of celebrate that, but we're scared to let our kids go and experience it because if they feel so vulnerable. It's if we can sit here and say, we should expose them to risk and they should feel it, but like, I mean, that's a really hard thing to do when you're in your, when it's your child, isn't it? Like, how did you find that when you were, like you were saying, your son was falling down the stairs, How did you not cave sooner? Do you know what I mean? How did you find that process?
It is hard. And I think one of the topics you raise and one of the things that really fascinates me is this whole attitude to risk. And you brought up some of the biases we have. And it's, and it is absolutely fascinating. And I think with the kids, the, you know, as a parent, you can imagine the worst thing that could possibly happen to your kids. And of course, you know, risk management is our tool. We don't, pretty much you don't eliminate risk. You eliminate some risks, but you're, it's all about managing risk. And risk is obviously a combination of severity and probability. And we get the probability wrong a lot in particular, because we have the knowledge from things that happen to friends, things you've seen on the TV, things that are in your worst nightmares about what the severity could be. But some of these things, the probability is close to zero. But the severity is what's stuck in your head. So you say, this is really high risk. No, it isn't. It's a high, if it goes wrong, it's horrible. But actually, it's a very low probability, and you have to look at both of those. And I think the, you know, the sort of the topic you raise as well is when it's happened to someone you know, then you think, well, yeah, I know, I don't know, I've got 20 friends with kids, and it's happened to one of them, so it must be a 5% chance it's going to happen. Well, no, it doesn't work like that. And a lot of people get those calculations around risk wrong. But as a parent, it's really hard because, you know, we're terrified of that worst case scenario, and you want to protect your kid from that worst case scenario. And I think I was getting on to the point of recognizing how hard it is for parents. So, you know, I live in Switzerland, and I'm always horrified when I go back to the UK, because you see schools that have got fences all the way around, no one's allowed in, there's security. You don't see kids walking to school on their own. Because the worst case scenario, you know, your child is kidnapped, you know, whatever, is doesn't bear thinking about. So we put all this protection in. In Switzerland, there's none of that. And you see kids 6, 7 years old walking to school on their own, going on the bus on their own. And it's seen as part of the Swiss culture, I think, is you have to learn to manage risk. Yeah, and they have a mindset that says, don't tell me what to do, tell me what the risks are, and then I'll make my own decisions. That's kind of the culture here. And I think the problem is, of course, that worst case is so bad, you want to do everything you possibly can to stop it happening. And we were talking before about unintended consequences, and I think one of the things is that the risk is that when they become adults, because they've been so protected through their childhood, they don't know how to manage risk. And one of the things talking to my son, he moved out to Switzerland with us, the youngest son, and went to an international school because he didn't speak German. And that school had a very wide range of people, including some very, very wealthy people who had moved here, or, you know, children of diplomats, Swiss people who wanted their kid to get an education in English rather than in German. And one of his friends got a Ferrari for their 17th birthday.
What the?
Yeah, that was my response as well. Now, nothing bad happened, but that mindset of putting your kid in a high-powered car at 17 years old when they've just learned to drive is just unbelievable. But it's it's that whole thing. You might protect them through their whole childhood, and then do something stupid like that, which really puts them at risk.
That's a good point.
And there's no logic between the two positions. So there's something about you have to expose them to some risk. Otherwise, they're not going to be, or they're less likely to be balanced adults when they grow up. And that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to create good, all-round, balanced adults. Yeah.
It's so hard, though, isn't it? Because I listen to... the words you're saying I love, but I'm telling you now I feel uncomfortable with my daughter just walking to school on her own. Like, it already makes me feel uncomfortable going to school, let alone kind of just saying, oh, off you go. Even, granted, she's four, so maybe that's a bit different, but, like, you know, when I see kids, you know, walking to school who are teenagers, I just think, Jesus Christ, it makes me feel terribly uncomfortable. And I think as well, it's not just about the kids feeling comfortable with risk, it's about the parents. It's probably more about the parents feeling comfortable with risk, right?
Yeah.
But
yeah,
ultimately as well, like, I think our visibility of risks like that to kids is a lot more. So, like, if I think to how my mother-in-law, you know, parents-in-law and all of that, how they talk about it. Oh, back in the day, you know, we would all just play in the street, and I'd go around Sheila's house. He lived four doors down, and it just disappeared. Even when I was a kid, I'm only 33. And I would just disappear into the woods next door to my house, you know, all day. To a point, John, I remember we found I'm going to say it was a mains water, but knowing how deep mains waters go now, I don't think it was mains water. I think it was like a sprinkler system for like the farm that went through the wood. But the hose was like underwater. We kind of found it, dug it up, pierced a hole in it so that we could drink out of it all day and not have to go home. Shout out, sorry to the farmer. Like, I was just a kid and I didn't realize what I was doing, but like, so we didn't have to go home. That's how long I was out for, in a wood in the middle of nowhere, like just off of a council house estate in Kettering in Northamptonshire. I'm not sure I feel comfortable with my daughter doing that now. Is it because the exposure or the awareness of those risks, in addition to severity, it makes the probability feel a lot more.
I think it is that, it's that perceived risk again, isn't it? And it's and of course you bring in another bias. Yeah, when we were kids and we did all this stuff and nothing bad happened to us, so it must be okay. But we're not the kids who ended up dying because something terrible happened when they were left on their own all day. And it's so that, you know, that's another bias. It was fine for us, it must be fine for our kids. But then as you say, there is so much more visibility on the bad things. I mean I don't have the numbers, but I remember someone talking about child abduction and stuff that happened, and they reckon that it hasn't changed in 100 years. You know, it's no worse now than it in the past, but there's a perception it's worse because you hear about it, and the media love the horror stories, so they, you know, they get full attention, so it feels like it's more probable, or the probability is higher when it probably isn't. But come back to that severity bit again. The severity, the worst case is so bad, you just never ever want that to happen to one of your children or anyone's children.
No.
So this is the real difficulties. I'm not saying this is easy, but it's about making judgments around how much risk you can tolerate, how much risk is a good thing. And you know, my daughter is about your age actually. And she's at the same stage. She's got a 4-year-old and a 2-year-old.
Wow.
And one of the things I really love about her, which I think has changed since I was a kid, was, and when I was raising kids, is that she's very, her big thing is on emotion, being able to express your emotions. So you'll never hear her say, don't cry.
yeah,
for example, to the kids. And it's, whereas we were told that all the time, and I can remember saying it to my kids, stop crying. It's get it, stand up, get on with it. She's really good at just saying, oh, you're obviously upset. And kind of like, are you hurt or are you just kind of shocked because you fell over? Mm. Yeah. And then she'll think about, why am I crying? And you can see her process, but the whole thing is the emotion is okay. Whether you're happy or sad or angry or all of this, it's all fine. But then what are you going to do about it? So I really recognize like that. Things change. And we also had that conversation about having, because I remember in one of your podcasts saying, all your good experiences, your bad experience, you're a product of all of those things. So you're not just a product of good parenting, you're also a product of bad parenting. And we don't know what impact that's going to have. So the bad parenting can actually create some personality traits that are excellent. You don't know. And I think this is really the problem with that sort of parenting is it's you can be on the face of it the best parent in the world and something can go wrong. You could be the worst parent in the world and your kid grows up fine. And you can't see ahead about how these things are going to impact. But I do think there's a lot of positive trends now. I think the beating your kids till they learn how to behave was probably not a good thing. But at the same time, how do you help your children grow up to be resilient? Mm. And just protecting them from everything is probably not the thing to do. So how do you manage?
And I think what you're talking about what your daughter's doing with her kids is quite fascinating, actually, because we don't. I can even see that now when I'm in myself and also people I work with and with my customers as well. It's that emotion plays such a big role in what we do, and we like to pretend that we're not emotional when we make decisions or when we choose to act a certain way, but in fact we actually are. So much of the time, everything that we do is based on reaction, based on emotion. But we're not really taught. I don't think I've ever been taught how to understand and regulate my own emotions. And I wouldn't say it's something that we're phenomenally good at, but it's something that we're aware and try to do with Maggie is just try to get her to stop for a moment, kind of breathe, and then vocalize how you're feeling. I think it's really hard to do for her and for us as well to know how to do that, because even not when she's like, we all imagine this situation when they're crying, like hysterically crying, but actually it's also like when she's, we call it zoomies because we've got a dog, like you ever see a dog have the zoomies where they just run around in circles non-stop? That's called dog zoomies, right? Well, my daughter does it as well. I think anyone that's got a 3-year-old, 4-year-old will probably know where they're so full of adrenaline or excitement that they're just typically just before bedtime as well, where they're just crazy. And you just like, there's no way to stop her do that. But to try and so we try and engage with her first, and I typically run up and down the kitchen or whatever with her and just act stupid. But then it's like, okay, let's try and just slow down and think about how we feel and why do we feel so wired right now. And I don't have the answer. I'm not a psychologist or especially not a child psychologist, but I think what your daughter's doing there is really cool. I really like that. And I feel like coming on to what you were talking about there, like I feel like it really sets them up for the future of like emotional resilience. Because I think about just myself in the last 3 years of running a business, having a kid, having another one, getting employees, and I just think, Jesus Christ, I thought I was emotionally resilient until all of this shit happened and realized I am not. and I don't really think I was ever really taught to how to navigate that at all.
No, nothing certainly for me as well, nothing at all. I don't know anyone who was, and it wasn't the done thing, and it was kind of frowned upon. I think maybe it's better in some cultures than others, but the British culture was not like that. No. You just get with stuff. And we know that when people make decisions, they think they make rational decisions, but they make the emotional decision and then they rationalize it. And it happens very quick in your brain. So it feels to you like it's a rational decision, but it's not.
Yeah.
You know, that's how we've evolved as human beings. And I think there's no, when you talk to your kids about how they feel, there's no right answer. But it's the good thing is you're talking to them about it and you're encouraging them to reflect. And that's hopefully a skill they can develop more and more and more. And by the time they're adults, they're really good at it. And then hopefully they are more emotionally resilient.
Because ultimately as well, like, I think if we look at it like, how stereotypically how boys were raised, like you were saying, it's definitely worse, I think, with boys. Like, grow up, be a man, you know, you're the man. I remember being like, I think 10 or 11 years old and being like told, you're the man of the house now. I was like, mate, I'm barely the man of my own life, let alone man of a house. Like, Jesus Christ, who says that to a little boy? And I just think, like, if you compare that to things like male suicide rates and stuff, I mean, it's a big jump, and I've got no evidence behind it, obviously, but there's got to be something in that kind of like, man it up, you know, men don't cry, all of this stuff, to now where we are now, which is shifting. You know, we're getting even brands of clothing that are literally called boys get sad too and stuff like that, which is amazing. So like this huge drive on like male mental health, that kind of man up kind of thing that was back in the past is really interesting. But then what I start to see as well on the flip side is a kind of conversely like a reaction against it as well, in that like, oh, boys aren't boys anymore, men aren't men anymore, which I find really interesting. Like, this period of change that we're going through is fascinating, but there's got to be, I mean, again, no evidence, I'm not saying this is true, but I would imagine there is a connection between boys being told to swallow your emotion and just suck it up and crack on, to how many men become serious people that have some serious issues with their own mental health.
And it's certainly not an expert on that topic, but it feels like there must be a connection. And I know I went through a whole period of thinking that the world was trying to feminize me. You know, that it seemed to be the modern world that I cannot be male anymore. You know, I used to play rugby when I was younger, and I loved it. You know, and then you get into, you know, that we, you know, we're supposed to talk about our emotions, and we're supposed to do this, we're supposed to do that, and. And actually, what was my stress relief was going and banging heads with people on a Saturday
afternoon. Someone,
and you were talking about sport before, and I realized at one point I actually felt quite angry, because I thought that somehow the world had decided that how women are is okay and how men are is not okay.
It's not okay. Totally agree.
So like, there was, you know, you could say about a woman, oh, you know, that there's something hormonal or menopause is an issue and it affects you. And then you've got a teenage boy who's full of testosterone and he's just a thug. And there's something wrong here, because both of those things are hormonally biased. And we don't feel sorry for the teenage boy who's... and got all this testosterone surging through him. So somehow there was a feminization. He should not be like that. And, you know, fighting is bad, and you know, any sort of aggression is bad. But I realized after a while, I think there is, there is some truth in that, but I think it's generally a good thing, or it can be a good thing if it's done in the right way. I think you can't in a modern society have that level of violence and aggression. And I'd say, unfortunately, in the news recently, we've seen a lot on the streets of those sort of things. But it's how you then transition from one to another. And talking about rugby, sorry, it's a little bit jumping from topic to topic, but you were talking about mental health. And I was getting very frustrated, because every speaker I saw on mental health was, an ex-executive businessman who'd had a breakdown because he was working too hard and was now talking about mental health. But I was kind of thinking, well, where's the normal people you can connect with? There's not many people in the world get to the top in business. And I'm sorry.
Yeah, like had a breakdown as a result of like the normality of life. Like I just had a 9-to-5 job and a family of five and it destroyed me kind of thing. Relatability.
And one of the things that really stood out, and I've forgotten his name, so I apologize for this, but there was a rugby league player from Lancashire.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Who describes this where he was sat in his car contemplating killing himself. And for me, it was so powerful because it highlighted this problem with that macho type of sport and how things were changing because he was now promoting this ability to talk to each other about how you feel and what's going on in your mind, which was not acceptable in the past.
His name was Danny Sculthorpe.
Yes.
Danny Sculthorpe.
Really good. You know, really worth a listen if you hear some good stuff. And it was just for me, I think those are the people we need to see and hear more of who can really talk about how they go through this. And he was going through it, of course, in that, because he was probably in his 20s when it happened. So he's going through it from that difficult period of going from a teenager to an adult and not having the support network in place, but realizing that you need that and you need ways of talking about this stuff. And it's so that for me was really powerful. I think much more than, a lot of the people who end up talking about mental health who are not relatable.
Totally. Totally. Sorry, I was slightly distracted there. My dog, bless him, is like a ball of fluff. And he's overdue a thing. And I think my room is the hottest room. And he's been shut in here, bless him, whilst the wife's out because we can't trust him. And I can tell that he is really hot. And I just feel really bad for him. I've seen Danny talk. And I think he's phenomenal. I think he's a really good speaker and a really quite a relatable story, which is really nice. I also think as well, like, which is really interesting. So a really close friend of mine, it has a very relatable story that I think nearly most men could relate to and has had some serious mental health issues. And there was a long period where a lot of us thought we would lose him, and he's been in hospital and lots of just a real horror story when it comes to mental health. Kind of what you were saying about boys being boys and men being men kind of thing, and this kind of testosterone, this in a way, this kind of need for aggression. Like, I do think there is something in men that requires some form of aggression, because you look at it like we love contact sports. Like, I've done contact sports nearly my entire life, like martial arts, rugby, like that stuff fuels me for so long.
Yeah.
And sometimes when I have a bad day, I just think, you know what? I wish I was going like rugby training or martial arts training tonight, because what would I like to do right now is punch someone in the bloody face or really smack into some massive forward. Yeah. That's genuinely what I do. And interestingly, my friend, so he'd gone through the whole process. He had been admitted into hospital and he'd had therapy and stuff. And what he does now is he goes to Frank Bruno's charity boxing organization, and he boxes like 2-3 days a week. And he does that to raise money for charity, obviously, but also as part of that, it's all about mental health. So nearly, not everybody, you don't have to have had, really serious mental health issues to go to that. You can just go and box there if you want to, but nearly everyone there has a story to tell around mental health.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you now, it has transformed him. It has transformed him. Just the ability to have that, I think, biological outburst that is needed as him as a bloke, which is good because he was a terrible rugby player. And if he listens to this, he'll know he was a terrible rugby player, but a damn good boxer, which none of us saw coming. None of us saw coming. A very good boxer. But he gets this need for his biological need to have some form of controlled aggression, but ultimately as well, he gets this, the counseling of this community of like-minded people that have gone through something, this relatability that you were talking about. But interestingly as well, what I see from him now is a lot more self-awareness and controlling himself. So I knew him phenomenally well before he was going through this stuff. And to say the guy was prone to outbursts would be probably an understatement. Like, we would have, he would be known as the person that would get a yellow or red card playing rugby. Like, he always have an outburst or a scrap with someone all the time. Like, proper hot-headed. Now, mate, he just kind of floats for life. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not making it sound like he's got nothing to deal with. Like, he lives with his kind of mind every day, and he obviously goes through ups and downs and peaks and troughs. But this kind of like you were saying, this kind of like, not, it's not, I don't want to say like kind of feminization, but I do think it is probably that. But like this demonization of aggression and violent things that we do, it's like all or nothing. We feel like if you do MMA, you're a thug. If you do mixed martial arts, you're a thug. Like, if you like boxing, you're a thug. Like, genuinely, there is a guy who I used to train with who has just been signed by the UFC. Phenomenal fighter. Unbelievable fighter. If you looked at him, you would probably cross the road. Like, he's got tattoos all over his face and under his eye and stuff like that. He looks quite scary. He's not massive, but he looks quite scary. He's the nicest guy I've ever met. Like, honestly, I remember being quite scared of him when the first time I was training in the same gym as him. And I was thinking, God, I hope I don't ever just end up sparring with him or whatever. One, he genuinely could kill me, but two, he's also quite scary. And then one day he always brought his baby to the training. One day I let him through the door. I'd held the door open for him. And he was like, oh, thanks, mate. And I was like, oh, he's human. Like, I've just like judged him in my head. Like, he's just a normal guy. And then we ended up just training a couple of times, not together, but like in like a round robin kind of thing. And we ended up just crossing paths. And just a few more I spoke to him, like, I wouldn't say I was friends with him, but like just know of him in there. And just a more and more I kind of interacted. I was like, he's just a really nice guy. But just so happened chosen career was scrapping in a professional manner. And he just so happened to be really bloody good at it. So I do find that there's, what I suppose I'm trying to say is that what we don't, I'm speaking for a very long time here, but I suppose what I'm trying to say is that I don't think we appreciate the complexity of the world that we live in, the different biologicals of people, the different natures of each, you know, a man to a man could be different and a woman, but a woman and a man and so on and so forth. All of these things are really complex. Yeah. Yeah. And I don't think we prepare children for that either.
Yeah, and you know, that is difficult. And I think, by the way, I think you picked a really good example, because when I was struggling with this, and I felt my emotional reaction was that someone was trying to make me more feminine, or the world was trying to make me more feminine. I think what you've highlighted, the correct positioning is that controlled aggression. I think, you know, it's a generalization. More men need it than women, I guess. It's more likely to be a male trait. But what you need to do if you want to live in a society, a civilized society, is control it. And what you describe with your friend is someone who learned how to control it. Now, if we could teach our kids that before they hit those difficult teenage years, when the hormones go crazy, if we could teach our sons that, then that would be amazing, because they will come through that experience a lot better. Than just not understanding what's going on.
I think it's massively underrated. There's a really good line that Joe Rogan says, which I'm going to butcher, but obviously he's a big martial arts, mixed martial arts fan and supporter, and works in that arena. But he says, you behave differently, you walk differently, and you react differently when you know that you can beat everybody in the room. And when he says beat, he means beat up. And I'll tell you now, it's true. Like, I don't think I'm any good at scrapping, but I'm relatively confident that if something kicked off, I could defend myself. Walking into a room of, say, people that you might normally be intimidated of, knowing that you could probably take most of them, yeah, if it all kicked off, it does, I think it does genuinely make you deal with things a lot calmer. Mm. When you're in a pub and something kicks off, when you're walking home on your own from a club or whatever it is, knowing that you can relatively handle yourself, that you could sprint off even, that whatever it is, yeah. I think it does make a difference. And I think it makes us less emotional. I think it's massively underrated to be able to defend yourself. I think it's huge. And even more so, having a girl, even more so for girls. Like, it's not encouraged for girls to learn how to defend themselves. And as much as I don't want to force my daughter to do anything, I really want to heavily encourage her to get into martial arts, to at least, not forever and become a UFC fighter, because I don't think I'd ever be comfortable with that either. But, like, I would, just knowing that she can look after herself if something kicked off, I think that's massively underrated as well.
Yeah. And my youngest son is a psychologist. He's doing his clinical psychology now, his PhD. And I mean, one of the things I learned from him was he talks a lot about the things that are a result of fear. And what you've kind of described is the opposite, that if you walk in a room without the fear, then you probably can be more yourself. And you can be...
And I'm no psychologist, but that's just my base theory, yeah.
And
I probably listen to your son more than me.
So I was telling him some stories from work and about, I think one of my strengths is not reacting. So when I worked in production, I was in a factory, running a factory. And one of the stories I had was a guy who just came up and he was shouting in my face. And as a human, that if someone shouts at you, you want to shout back. If someone hits you, you want to hit back. And there's kind of this natural reaction. And one of the things I really learned early on was someone said to me, and it's a cliche, but it's a good one, is that responsibility means having the ability to respond. And this was exactly the situation he was describing. You're in charge. You're the manager. Your responsibility is not to just react to this guy shouting at you, is to listen. And we ended up, I said, look, let's find somewhere quiet, have a chat. Let's not do this on the shop floor. What's the problem? And it turned out it was a safety issue. And I was new in the job and he had this issue that no one had dealt with and he was angry. And the thing that my son has then said recently when I was telling that story was, it's fear. Anger comes from fear. And we talk about psychological safety, but physical safety also creates, or lack of physical safety creates an environment where people are afraid and then they behave differently. And in that situation, if I just reacted, and I remember one of the supervisors saying, you should not let him talk to you like that. You should take him to HR. If I'd done that, I never would have learned what the issue was. And in terms of creating a good culture or a step in the right direction, that whole incident taught people that I was prepared to listen. And it didn't create an environment where it's okay to just go around shouting and screaming at everybody, but actually the guy was so, he was not only afraid for the safety issue, he was afraid of speaking his mind and what might happen. Ooh. So he wasn't able to do it in a nice, controlled, even way. He was so wound up that all he could do was shout. And being able to recognize that and respond in the right way and learn something, I think, again, is a way of dealing with the world. And it's one of the things, again, one of the things I try to teach my kids is it's not, they're all different. So it's not about be like me. It's not about don't be emotional, but it's about it is all about how to deal with that. And I suppose it's one of the other stories it kind of comes on to, in very related to what we were just talking about, is the middle child, the oldest of my two boys, was quite angry, reactionary, more aggressive than the others. And one of the things that really stands out in my memory and his, he said it was the most influential point of his whole childhood, or his whole teenage years, was he was behaving quite badly, and particularly in the way he was talking to his mother. And I rationally in my head said, now is the time to deal with this, because right. very soon he's going to be bigger and stronger than me. I'm not going to be able to physically dominate him. And because of his style and because he needed boundaries, the right approach was a physical one. So I did this all very rationally. As soon as I started to implement what I decided to do, all the rationality went out the window. But what I did was I grabbed him by the collar, lifted him up, slammed him against the wall. So I did this. This was a deliberate act. But as soon as I started doing it, the emotions just went through the roof. But I held him up against the wall and banged him against the wall and said, you do not ever talk to your mother like that ever again. That was it. That was the message. And then put him down. And at which point I burst into tears because the emotion was there. And actually what had the biggest impact on him was the fact that I'd burst into tears. Because it got him to reflect on his behavior. He said, I made my dad cry. And I feel ashamed. And I'm not, you know, and shame isn't necessarily the right sort of learning mechanism. But it did have a big impact on him. And again, it's related to emotion. But if there was a better way to learn about emotions than to go through that, then that surely would be a good thing.
You told me that story when we were in Berlin, and I think what is really quite interesting and probably quite impressive, I think, is that your ability to have assessed the different situations and different needs of each child. So you'd gone, this one needs clear boundaries, whereas you know, the others maybe not so, whatever. And I think that's something that we lack when we look at risk management. And again, coming back to your earlier very valid, very important point, the point of this conversation is to not compare employees to children, because they most certainly are not, they're adults. But ultimately, like, we seem to lose a lot of stuff when we go to work. That appreciation of like, your three kids are different, it still applies in the workplace, and that every employee is different, that some require clear guidance and clear boundaries and step-by-step process, and some like freedom and autonomy and stuff more so than others. And I, do you know what I find it really interesting, which is not family related, but we do the I do the Lego duck exercise a lot in my work, and you know how much I love Lego. I always give these little Lego ducks out, and I say, like, just build a duck. Just build a duck. Mm. And this one lady in one workshop, just like, to say she freaked out would probably be fair. Like, she would just refuse to do it. And I was like, don't overthink it. Just like, to build a duck. Like, don't worry. Mm. No one's judging or anything. That's the point of the exercise. It's a bit of fun. Don't overthink it. And she was like, no. She explained to me at lunchtime, and I can't remember, but she had a condition where basically that type of freedom completely shuts her down, which I thought was fascinating. And we definitely lose that. I was talking to a friend of mine. My friend of mine came around the house last night, and he's got two girls. And he said to us, like, because he's not got boys, and I don't currently, but I have a boy on the way. So we have one girl and one boy, very jammy of us. But he was like, do you think it'll be different with a boy?
Hmm.
And I was like, you know what? I've pondered this a lot since we found out it was a boy, because I have some childhood issues, let's say, as we all do. The relationship of father and son is definitely very, very prominent in that childhood trauma per se. And I'm very aware of what that looks like. And I am curious to see if I am different. But then listening to you, and kind of like, well, I might have to be, because one's a boy and one's a girl. One's one child, one's Maggie, and one's name pending. Yeah. You know, they are different people. And they, they will like different things and need different things and have different wants and needs and desires and so on. Yeah. So the answer should probably quite confidently be, yes, I will be different because they are different people.
Yeah.
But that feels wrong to be like that. Like I want to say no, I'll treat them all the same and they should be the same. Yeah. And I think it's because go on.
Yeah, I was going to say, this is one of the things, again, relating it to the workplace, because we talk about equality and we say that everybody should get the same. No, everybody should get what they need.
Yeah.
Which can be different for different people. And and there is a risk that it can look unfair at times. Why did they get that and I didn't? But actually trying to understand what people need and what your kids need, I think it's paramount. It's that they're not the same. No two people are the same. So you need to treat them differently.
And I find as well what I find myself doing, which I've kind of, and I see it in my wife as well, which I think we've kind of brought from work into household. But like, and you kind of touched on it earlier, but we have a real question-based approach. So like, we often ask Maggie, well, what do you want? What are you trying to say to us? Like, there's a lot of like question instead of tell. I always feel like my mum, was always tell me what I want, tell me what I felt, tell me what I should do. Whereas Maggie, we very much question her a lot. And I do find like, I mean, this comes back to a lot of like what Todd says in his work of like, ask better questions. We don't do that at work anywhere near enough. And a lot of the work that we do at Risk Fluent is about trying to enable safety people, business leaders, whatever they are, to just ask more questions, create situations in which you can explore different perspectives. And I don't think we explore a child's perspective anywhere near enough.
I think that's a really fascinating point. And it's something you need to learn, because it's, You can't ask the questions in a way to a 2-year-old where you give them full responsibility for everything. So there's a balance of telling and asking, and it's trying to learn when that is. But it is different with a 2-year-old than it is with a 10-year-old or a 15-year-old. You need to develop that where they can engage in the questions and the discussion. But you've also got to develop as a parent, so that you change your methods as they grow up.
You have to build that kind of like framework around it, which I find really interesting. Both you and I know Teresa very well. And I remember what Teresa told me many years ago was like, we have to build a framework for which people operate within. It's not about just complete freedom. It's freedom within a framework. And I was like, and that's always stuck with me. And that's kind of what I think what we do. And I think many parents do with kids as well is they'll go, right, do you want chicken or beef? Right. Yeah. Instead of going, what do you want for dinner? You go, do you want chicken or beef? Obviously, you wouldn't just give them a slice of chicken and fry beef, but whatever. You're like, chicken or beef? And they're like, oh, chicken. So you've done a couple of things. You've like created an opportunity for ownership. So you've had the IKEA effect where they feel like they've chose themselves and they've got that ownership. Mm. They've owned that decision. So I'm going to eat this chicken because I chose it. It's not as simple as that, FYI. They still don't eat the bloody chicken. But that aside, we don't do that in the workplace either. Like that kind of, right, we need to do this. What do you guys think is the best solution? What the managers do, because we're managers now and we know better, we know we need to do this and we think you should do it like that. It's very much a parent and child approach to work, but it's this old school parent child approach where we're telling the child. So I always find I apply a lot of my work to raising my children, but I probably do take a lot of raising my children into work, if I'm honest. And the two are interchangeable.
Absolutely. And I love that sort of that transactional analysis model with the, you're adult to adult or parent to child, or how are you engaging with people? And, at work, it needs to be adult to adult, and often it isn't. And I remember a very clear conversation with one of my line managers, and not so long ago, within the last 10 years, And we were talking about why things weren't working at my mid-year review. And I said to him, your style is critical parent. And I said, the reason I know that is because I'm reacting as rebellious child, because that's how I react as a critical parent.
Nice.
So, it kind of broke the ice, because we're then talking about this theory rather than saying you're like this and it's wrong. It was talking about this theory. We found a way to work together better.
I like that.
But it was that parent child in work doesn't work. But at the same time, you can't do adult to adult with a 2-year-old. And we tried. So we tried to reason with our kids on everything and made all those mistakes. They said, give them too many choices, don't set the boundaries. When they were not capable of making those decisions, and then realizing you have to do it a bit at a time. So that by the time they're teenagers, it is a bit more adult to adult. The balance shifts. But when they're younger, it's trying to understand when is it okay to introduce a bit of that. And I love your thing about giving 2 choices rather than, an infinite number of choices. Because that's, talking about my son who needed the boundaries, that's the thing that would just tip him over the edge. He was hungry and he wanted his dinner and you say, what do you want? That's it. He'd have a complete meltdown. All he wanted was to have a plate of food put in front of him that he could eat.
and also, if you ask a child what they want, you know what they want. They want chocolate, sweets. Like my daughter would just be like, chocolate spread. That's all she eats at the minute, chocolate spread. But I find an interesting comparison is when we kind of broaden this framework up too much. So an interesting comparison for me is when my experience of, say, reading like Decker's work, for example, and going in and like trying to dramatically declutter the process where we're going like, this procedure is shit, get rid of it. This risk is under, get rid of it. This is shit, this is shit, and get rid of loads of stuff. But actually the response from the shop floor has not been like, yes, James, it's all shit, which is what I thought I was going to get. So this was like, I don't know, free job before going self-employed. And I just found that like the framework might not be right. Yes. And I think that's what a lot of new views safety is saying, that the framework's not right. It's not getting you what you want. Agreed. But throwing it out is like completely removing this framework and just giving a complete blank sheet. And in comparison, it's kind of like going to a child, what do you want? Now, again, not saying employees are children, but it is just, it's too much. Like you're going from something to nothing. And it's this phased approach that we don't apply to the workforce either. We kind of go from all to nothing, all to nothing, or nothing to all in a way. We don't engage people whilst we're doing it. And it's just, there's so much we can learn from this. It's just how we run a household in a way.
Yeah, I think so. And we know, I mean, anyone who's tried to put in a new initiative at work, it's usually fails because people hate completely new stuff. And we seem very slow at learning that actually you need to develop and improve what you've got, not throw it all out and do something new. And I think that's what you've highlighted, is that we do need to know something about psychology and how people work and how people think. But there'll be things in that workplace that people are comfortable with, and there'll be things they hate, and things that don't work. And trying to find the things that don't work you could remove from their life, that you make their life easier, is going to be successful. Trying to change everything is not going to be successful. And I think that's the adult to adult conversation. And one of the HOP things I love, we obviously met when we were doing the HOP training together, is that whole thing about drift. And if you go into the workplace and you say, if you're doing a safety inspection and you say, why aren't you following the procedure, you're not going to get a very good reaction. But if you educate people, if you explain the concept of drift, and then you say, have you seen any examples of drift in your workplace? You'll learn very quickly about the procedures that don't work and aren't followed. And you've removed all the blame, all the judgment, all of those things. And you've you've given this concept to somebody, you've treated them as an adult, you've explained to them that they're the expert in their job. I'm not the expert. I've just been here 10 minutes. You're the expert in your job. So, you know, do you have any of the examples? And I've had really good engagement on those things. And it's and it's finding those ways of having the adult to adult conversation in a way that gets you the outcome you know, not say, I was going to say what you want. It sounds like too manipulative. I don't mean that, but I mean, it gets you a positive outcome that works for everybody.
Like conducive.
Whereas if you go and say, we need to improve this procedure, then you're telling, you're not asking, and you're not treating people with respect.
And I find always an allergic reaction to this newer approach to safety is that that people are very scared that we just throw all accountability and responsibility out the window, which I find is a complete misunderstanding. But I can kind of understand how it comes to that misunderstanding. And I interestingly, I can't remember where the bloody hell I read it, what the book was, who the author was, or anything. It was years ago, and I will never forget this little story. And this was always how I explained to myself what New View Safety looked like. And it wasn't a New View author, it was something completely different. And it was this guy that he basically said he had a, I think he was like a 18, 19 year old daughter, and he didn't want her to drink when she goes out to have a house party. So he didn't want her to go to like a house party and drink alcohol. So the rule was no drinking when you're out. I think they're in America. So I think the context there was that 21, you're not allowed to drink. So anyway, there's a lot more to this story but this is all I can remember. He gets in the car and the daughter gets in the car, and he could smell alcohol on her. And he could tell that she had been drinking. And this guy says, in my head, I wanted to have a go at her for breaking my rule. You broke my rule. You're the lack of respect of me as your parent. You should listen to me, blah, blah. I know better than you. And I realized that maybe it would be better to understand why she broke the rule than the just bollocking her for breaking the rule, which is kind of what I was talking about with Maggie earlier. And basically he was like, look, I can smell the alcohol. Here's my stance. And he just explained his position as to why he had that rule. So he was like, this is why I wanted the rule. This is why it's important to me. This is what I'm worried about for you. These are the risks. This is a blah, blah, blah. And he basically just detailed his risk assessment in a way, right? He just kind of detailed his assessment of risk and why he'd implemented that mitigation. And then he went, this was the clanger for me. This was what really made it. Then he went, now, if you don't mind, I'd just like you to kind of explain why that didn't work in this situation where you are, because it clearly hasn't worked. And she went, yeah, you're right, Dad, it hasn't worked. I did have a drink. I had a couple of drinks. And he said, okay, just tell me why. Why did that happen? And let's see if we can collaboratively come up with a solution. And she told him, and she said, but you know what? I didn't actually like it, but I've never tried it before. And I can't remember what the solution was, but they collaboratively came up with this new rule, but they did it together. And they didn't do it through screaming at each other. And they didn't do it through blame and account. So for me, when I read that, I remember reading that, and I remember thinking, that's what we're trying to say. We're not saying don't have the rule. What we're saying is implement the rule. And then when it doesn't work, talk to people about understanding why it didn't work and how we need to change the rule. And if in that process you go, okay, now we've listened to both sides of those, and actually I feel like this rule still should apply. What do you feel like? And then if you get to a position of having to hold someone to account, maybe, but ultimately that story for me was just a beautiful way of dealing with a breaking of a rule is a conversation to understand the context. And I feel like that was what New View was trying to say. And I just found it funny that us talking about kids and family, it reminded me of that. And it was years ago that I read that, but it really good.
Yeah. Nice story. And I think it's the adult to adult conversation. And you said 18, 19 year old, and that's an adult. So actually telling them they've done wrong and punishing them because you haven't followed my rules is not going to get a positive outcome. However frustrated you feel and however angry you feel, back to responsibility again. That parent figured out how to take responsibility for what's happening. Because he's right, they broke his rule. It wasn't their rule, it was his rule. So maybe we need a different approach, a different context. Yeah, I really like that story. It's a nice one.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I really, really enjoyed it. John, we've been speaking for over an hour. I think we've probably been speaking for about an hour with our interruptions and our internet issues and so on. Yeah. And I apologize for all of them because I think they were all my fault. But if... well, before we tie it up, is there anything we didn't cover that you would like to cover before we tie it up?
No, I think I didn't have any particular things. Just look, I didn't scribble a few things down beforehand, but I think there's just so many parallels, and it's not treating employees like kids, but it's that crossover, as you described, between work and home. And in recognizing the continuity, you don't have children who one day become adults. It's a gradual process that happens over a lot of years. I think what we've talked about is a little bit about how you manage that process and you end up in a position where you are having those adult-to-adult conversations. It's great.
I think it's all like, if we think about what we're trying to achieve, it's like safer, healthier workplaces, right? For me, that starts with building children, raising children that can have adult-to-adult conversations, that can assess risk themselves, that can have a good understanding of risk. Interestingly, as a kind of tie it off, I suppose we didn't probably talk about risk as much as we probably should have, but I suppose we spoke more about the discussions of risk that we have with people. But we've got a customer who's a trust of schools, and when we were onboarding with them and going through the early stages of the process, I kind of approached him and said, there's one thing I've always really wanted to do with a school, and I've approached two schools in the past to do it and pretty much got laughed out of the room, is that schools go on field trips and they go out on the, you know, wherever it is, they stay away camping, they do whatever.
Yeah.
And all of these things have to be risk assessed. So the teachers or somebody in the school is doing a risk assessment. Yeah. Are they or are they not? And they were like, yes, they totally are. They have to do it per every trip. I was like, okay, cool. I would love to get to a point where the teachers are doing that risk assessment with the children in the class, where we're saying, right, kids, we're going to here. Here's some pictures. Here's the information. Here's what we're going to do. Can we think of things that could hurt us in this process? Like, what could really hurt us? Well, I could fall off that thing, miss. Oh, yep, right, okay. So fall from height. Let's put that on there. And to do a risk assessment with them. Not to teach them how to type up a bloody risk assessment, but to teach them to identify hazards, to teach them to come up with mitigations and understand that process a little bit more. But really also selfishly to just get a bloody good risk assessment right at the end of it, I think.
Because you don't do a risk assessment at work without the worker. Or you shouldn't.
Exactly.
If you're doing a risk assessment for children's safety, do it, or teenage or whatever age, do it with them. I think I told you the story, because my daughter, we sent her on this thing called Forest School Camps when she was 8 years old.
Yes.
And she's
go on, tell it. That was really cool.
She now volunteers, and it's exactly one thing I loved is that, and at that time I took her to King's Cross, 8 years old. I put her on a train with some people who were going to the camp, waved her off, and I went and picked her up 2 weeks later with no communication in between. Their model is they go out into the middle of nowhere and they have boating camps and they have hiking camps, they do all sorts of stuff. But they have to dig their own toilets. They entertain themselves. It's organized, but it's kind of like scouts with anarchy and with no uniforms. But we did this. But what we found out was the first night they sit around the campfire with the kids. And obviously some of them have been going for years and some of them are new. So there's a history. But the adults who organize it say, right, the first thing we need to do is come up with the rules for the camp with all the kids. And they say there's two things that are given is no one is excluded and everybody keeps safe. But we're not going to give any other rules. So what rules should we have for the camp? And they figure out how they're going to include people and how they're going to keep safe. And one thing I realized when I picked my daughter up is one rule they never, ever, ever come up with as kids is you have to wash every day and you shouldn't swear. So when I picked my daughter up from the station 2 weeks later, she was filthy. And she hadn't worn most of her clothes. She just worn the same stuff for 2 weeks. And I said, oh, yeah, how was it? It was fucking excellent, was the response I got from my eight-year-old daughter.
Love that story.
But what it made me think was, yeah, because what they've done is they've come up with the important rules. And actually, you have to wash and clean your teeth every day. You know, it doesn't matter too much for 2 weeks if you're camping.
Yeah, right, for a week.
Does it matter if you swear? Not really. Doesn't hurt anybody. So, yeah. So, yeah, she learned some new things, let's say.
Nice.
Yeah.
And now she's you said it at the beginning, I think, but she's like a trustee or something for the...
Yeah, she was doing their fundraising. I'm not sure if she's still doing that, but her and her husband now, and that's how they met on this forest school camp. So she did it from 8 years all the way through. She's now 33 and still doing it. And wow. But she's organising camps. So her and her husband are now organising one that's a boating one on the Norfolk Broads with a group of kids, including their own kids at 2 and 4 years old. They're taking them on a boat for a week on the Norfolk Broads. So,
nice. Yeah.
Talk about risk assessment. Yeah. I wouldn't trust my 2-year-old grandson on a boat unless he was tied on to something.
My wife goes up to Sheffield quite a lot to see her old uni mates. And I can't remember why. Me and Maggie don't normally go with. Oh, so yeah. So they'd arranged this day on like a big boating lake. I think we'd planned for me and Maggie to go with, and we'd go on the day and like me and Maggie could do something whilst they're there. And classic James, I hadn't really done any planning. I just was like, yeah, we'll be able to get a boat or something or do something when we get there. We got there, was like nothing. I was like, okay, cool. So I went and had a look at the thing, and then I was like, what age? So she would have been about, I think she'd have just turned 3. And I was like, could I get a 3-year-old into a boat and just boat around the lake? And if I could do that, would she be good and would she enjoy it? When I say boat, I mean essentially like a canoe or something, or a kayak or something like that. Because Sherry and her friends were paddleboarding on the lake. So I went in and to the shop and I was like, is there any situation where I could take this one, this tiny little thing, on a boat with me? She was like, how old is she? I was like, 3 years old. Yeah, that's fine. We've got like little life jackets and she can go in a canoe. And I was like, oh, amazing. I was like, Maggie, do you want to go on a boat? She's like, yeah. I was thinking, she's going to want to do this for about 5 minutes. We boated around this lake singing Row, Row, Row Your Boat for about an hour. And I've never seen her sit so still. She just sat still the entire time going around the lake. And I was like, I don't know what we've done. What magic has happened here, but something is wrong with my daughter because she don't sit still at all. She's like me. She can't sit still. I just found it fascinating. I don't know what it was, whether it was just she had all of my attention. There was no one else around. I don't know whether it was that. It was just me and her on a boat, whether it's the fact she'd never been on a boat before. I really don't know, but she loved it. And she just sat there.
Yeah. And I think that attention thing is really important because I've noticed the difference between a parent and a grandparent, or for myself. You realize when you're a parent, you've got so much to do. You've got to earn a living. You've got to cook meals. You've got to do the washing, gardening, all of that stuff. The actual amount of time you have to give your children your full attention is quite small.
Yep.
And then when you're a grandparent, when I visit them, I'm just there for them. Full stop.
Yeah.
I have nothing else. And they get my full attention. And I've realized this is why kids seem to love their grandparents. I think it's just because for once someone is giving them full attention. I think it's so important, but it's so hard to do as a parent because you've got so much other stuff going on in your life.
You've got so much to do. Yeah. Yeah. That's a really good point, actually. Really good point. Mm. And a nice point for us to tie it up on, John. Yeah. I think a very nice. There. I'm glad we covered those last couple of points, actually. And I remember you telling that story about your daughter, and that's quite funny. I like that. John, if anyone wants to get hold of you, do you want to give us a little plug on kind of what you do and how people wanted to get hold of you if they wanted to and so on?
Yeah, if they want to get hold of me, they can find me on LinkedIn or johnpears@gmail.com. You can get hold of me. I finished work in the corporate world a year ago, almost exactly a year ago, and I've been consulting since then. I'm doing some work for Get the Grit, who used to be called Paradigm, who are doing Hop, and I'm also a consultant with Haztam in the UK, and I'm also doing some independent work on safety culture, and you know, a lot of this topic we've been discussing is about creating the right culture. So if they want to get hold of me, they can reach out, and happy to have a chat with anybody.
Amazing. We'll put your LinkedIn in the description and stuff as well, so people can get that way. But thank you very much for your time, John. It's been a pleasure chatting to you.
It's been a real pleasure. Yeah, thanks a lot, James. Thanks for the invitation.
Expressed in this podcast are those of the host and its guests and do not necessarily reflect the position of the companies. Examples of analysis discussed within this podcast are examples only based on limited and dated open source information and should not be utilised in real life as the only solution available. Assumptions made within this analysis are not reflective of the position of the companies. No part of this podcast may be reproduced, stored or transmitted in any form or by any means, mechanical, electronic or otherwise, without prior written permission from James McPherson. We'll be right back.